The confusion leaves me, and I finally, finally, finally can relax. I sigh, and she laughs. And may I congratulate you on your match. It's caused quite a stir. People are talking about it all over the province. Perhaps even all through the society. It hasn't happened in many years. She pauses briefly and then continues. I don't suppose you brought your microcard with you tonight. Actually, I did. I pull it out of my pocket. I was worried. I didn't want anyone else to see. She holds out her hand, and I drop the microcard in its protective plastic sleeve into her outstretched palm. Perfect. I'll take care of this. She places it inside her small official's case. I catch a glimpse of her tablet container and notice that it is larger than standard issue. She sees my glance. Higher-level officials carry extra, she says, in case of an emergency. I nod, and she continues. But that's not something you need to worry about. Now this is for you. She takes another microcard from a side pocket inside the case. I've checked it myself. Everything is in order. Thank you. Neither of us says anything for a few moments after I slip the new microcard into my pocket. At first, I look around at the grass and the metal benches and the small concrete fountain in the center of the green space, which sends up silvery wet showers of water every few seconds. Then I peek over at the woman next to me, trying to catch a glimpse of the insignia on her shirt pocket. I know she is an official because she wears white clothing, but I'm not sure which department of society she represents. I'm part of the matching department, authorized to deal with information malfunctions, the official says, noticing my glance. Fortunately, we don't have much work to do. Since the matching is so important to the society, it's very well regulated. Her words remind me of a paragraph in the official matching material. The goal of matching is twofold: to provide the healthiest possible future citizens for our society, and to provide the best chances for interested citizens to experience successful family life. It is of the utmost importance to the society that the matches be as optimal as possible. I've never heard of a mistake like this before. I'm afraid it does happen now and then, not often. She is silent for a moment, and then she asks the question that I do not want to hear. Did you recognize the other person whose face you saw? Suddenly and irrationally, I am tempted to lie. I want to say that I have no idea, that I have never seen that face before. I look over at the fountain again, and as I watch the rise and fall of the water, I know that my pause gives me away. So I answer, yes. Can you tell me his name? She already knows all of this, of course, so there is nothing to do but tell the truth. Yes, Kai Markham. That's what was so strange about the whole thing. The odds of a mistake being made, and of a mistake being made with someone else I know, are virtually non-existent, she agrees. That's true. It makes us wonder if the error was intentional, some kind of joke. If we find the person, we will punish them severely. It was a cruel thing to do, not only because it was upsetting and confusing for you, but also because of Kai. Does he know? No, he has no idea. The reason I said it was cruel to use him as part of this prank is because of what he is. What he is? Kai Markham moved to our borough back when we were 10. He is good-looking and quiet. He's very still. He is not a troublemaker. I don't see him as much as I once did. Last year, he received his work position early, and he no longer goes to second school with the rest of the youth in our borough. The official nods and leans a little closer, even though there is no one around to hear us. The light from the lamp above shines down, hot, and I shift a little.
This is confidential information, but Kai Markham could never be your match.
he will never be anyone's match. He's chosen to be a single, then. I'm not sure why this information is confidential. Lots of people in our school have chosen to be single. There's even a paragraph about it in the official matching material. Please consider carefully whether you are a good candidate to be matched. Remember, singles are equally important in the society. As you are aware, the current leader of the society is a single. Both matched and single citizens experience full and satisfying lives. However, children are only allowed to be born to those who choose to be matched. She leans closer to me. No, he's not a single. Kai Markham is an aberration. Kai Markham is an aberration? Aberrations live among us. They're not dangerous, like anomalies, who have to be separated from society. Though aberrations usually acquire their status due to an infraction, they are protected. Their identities aren't usually common knowledge. Only the officials in the Societal Classification Department and other related fields have access to such information. I don't ask my question out loud, but she knows what I'm thinking. I'm afraid so. It's through no fault of his own, but his father committed an infraction. The society couldn't overlook a factor like that, even when they allowed the Markhams to adopt Kai. He had to retain his classification as an aberration, and as such, was ineligible to be entered in the matching pool. She sighs. We don't make the microcards until a few hours before the banquet. It's likely the error occurred then. We're already checking to see who had access to your microcard. Who could have added Kai's picture before the banquet? I hope you find out who did it, I say. You're right. It's cruel. We'll find out, she says, smiling at me. I can promise you that. Then she looks down, glances at her watch. I have to leave now. I hope that I've been able to eliminate your concern. Yes, thank you. I try to pull my thoughts from the boy who is an aberration. I should be thinking about how wonderful it is that everything is back in order. But instead, I think about Kai, how sorry I feel for him, how I wish I didn't have to know this about him and could have gone on thinking he had chosen to be a single. I don't need to remind you to keep the information about Kai Markham confidential, do I? She asks mildly, but I hear the iron in her voice. The only reason I shared it with you was so that you could know without a doubt that he was never intended to be your match.
Of course, I won't say anything to anyone.
Good. It's probably best that you keep this to yourself. Of course, we could call a meeting if you would like. I could explain to your parents, and Xander and his parents, what happened.
No, I say forcefully. No, I don't want anyone to know, except...
Except who?
I don't answer, and suddenly her hand is on my arm. She does not grip me roughly, but I can tell that she will wait out the answer to her brief question.
Who?
My grandfather, I admit. He's almost 80. She lets go of my arm.
When is his birthday?
Tomorrow. She thinks for a moment, then nods.
If you feel that you need to talk to someone about what happened, he would be the optimal one.
Still.
That is the only person?
Yes, I say. I don't want anyone else to know. I don't mind Grandfather knowing, because... I leave the sentence unfinished. She knows why. At least one of the reasons why, anyway.
I'm glad you feel that way,
the official says, nodding.
I have to admit that it makes things easier for me. Obviously, when you talk to your grandfather, you will tell him that he will be cited if he mentions this to anyone else. And that's certainly not something he wants now. He could lose his preservation privileges.
I understand. The official smiles, stands up. Is there anything else I can help you with today?
I am glad the interview is over. Now that all is right again with my world, I want to take my place back inside that room full of people. It suddenly feels very lonely out here. No, thank you. She gestures at the path leading back to the center.
Best wishes to you, Kasia. I'm glad I could help.
I thank her one last time and walk away. She stays behind, watching me go. Even though I know it's nonsense, I feel as if she watches me all the way to the door, all the way down the halls and back into the room and over to the table where Xander still plays the game. He looks up and holds my gaze. He noticed that I was gone. Everything all right? His eyes ask me, and I nod. It is now. Everything is back to normal, better than normal. Now I can again enjoy the fact that I've been matched with Xander. Still, I wish she hadn't told me about Kai. I won't be able to look at him the same way again, now that I know too much about him. There are so many of us inside the game center. It is hot and humid in the room, reminding me of the tropical ocean simulation we had in science once, the one about the coral reefs that teemed with fish before the warming killed them all. I taste sweat and breathe water. Someone bumps into me as an official makes an announcement over the main speaker. The crowd goes quiet to listen.
Someone has dropped their tablet container. Please stand completely still and do not speak until we locate it.
Everyone stops immediately. I hear the clatter of dice and a soft thud as someone, perhaps Xander, puts down a game piece. Then all is quiet. No one moves. A lost container is a serious matter. I look at a girl near me, and she stares back at me, wide-eyed, open-mouthed, frozen in place. I think again of that ocean simulation, how the instructor paused it in the middle to explain something. And the fish projected around the room stared back at us, unblinking, until she switched the simulation back on. We all wait for the switch to be thrown, for the instructor to tell us what comes next. My mind begins to wander, to escape this place where we all stand still. Are there other unknown aberrations standing here in this room? Swimming in this water? Water. I recall another memory of water, real this time, a day when Xander and I were 10. Back then, we had more free recreation time, and in the summers, we almost always spent it at the swimming pool. Xander liked to swim in the blue chlorinated water. I liked to sit on the pockmarked cement side of the pool and swish my feet back and forth before I went in. That's what I was doing when Xander appeared next to me, a worried look on his face.
I've lost my tablet container, he told me quietly.
I glanced down to make sure that mine was still hooked to my swimwear. It was. Its metal clip snapped securely to the strap over my left shoulder. We'd had our tablet containers for a few weeks, and at that point they contained one tablet, the first one, the blue one. The one that can save us. The one with enough nutrients to keep us going for several days if we have water, too. There was plenty of water in the pool. That was the problem. How was Xander ever going to find the container?
It's probably underwater, I said. Let's get the lifeguard to clear the pool.
No, Xander said, his jaw set. Don't tell them. They'll cite me for losing it. Don't say anything. I'll find it. Carrying our own tablets is an important step toward our own independence. Losing them is the same as admitting we aren't ready for the responsibility. Our parents carry our tablets for us until we are old enough to take them over, one by one. First the blue when we are 10, then when we turn 13, the green one, the one that calms us if we need calming. And when we're 16, the red one. The one we can only take when a high-level official tells us to do so. At first, I tried to help Xander, but the chlorine always hurt my eyes. I dove and dove, and then, when my eyes burned so much I could barely see,
I climbed back onto the cement next to the pool and tried to look beneath the sun-dazzled waves. None of us ever wears a watch when we are small. Time is kept for us. But I still knew. I knew that he had been under the water much longer than he should. I had measured it out in heartbeats. Did he drown? For a moment, I was blinded by sunlight slanting off the water, bright white and paralyzed by my fear, which felt bright white too. But then I stood up and drew a deep breath into my lungs to scream to the world, "Xander is under the water! Save him! Save him!" Before my scream was born, a voice I did not know asked, "Is he drowning?" "I can't tell," I said, tearing my eyes away from the water. A boy stood next to me, tanned skin, dark hair, a new boy. That was all I had time to notice before he vanished, slipping under the surface in one quick motion. A pause, a few more slaps of the waves against the cement, and Xander's head popped up above the water. He grinned triumphantly at me, holding the waterproof case. "Got it," he said. "Xander," I said, relieved, "are you all right?" "Of course," he said, the confident light back in his eyes. "Why would you think I wouldn't be?" "You were under so long that I thought you were drowning," I admitted. "And so did that boy." Suddenly, I panicked. Where did the other boy go? He had not come up for air.
"What boy?" Xander asked, puzzled.
"He went searching for you." And then I saw him, below the blue, a shadow under the water. "He's right there! Is he drowning?" Just then, the boy broke the surface of the water. Coughing, his hair glistening, a red scrape, almost healed but still noticeable, ran along his cheek. I did my best not to stare. Not just because injuries are uncommon in a place where we are all so healthy and safe, but because he was unknown to me, a stranger. It took the boy a few moments to catch his breath again. When he did, he looked at me but spoke to Xander, saying,
"He didn't drown."
"No," agreed Xander.
"You almost did, though."
"I know," the boy said.
"I meant to save you," he corrected himself. "I mean, to help you."
"Don't you know how to swim?" I asked him.
"I thought I did," the boy said, which made both Xander and me laugh.
The boy looked into my eyes and smiled. The smile seemed to surprise him. It surprised me, too, the warmth of it. The boy looked back at Xander.
"She looked worried when you didn't come back up."
"I'm not worried anymore," I said, relieved that everyone was safe. "Are you visiting someone?" I asked the boy, hoping he was staying for a long visit. I already liked him because he had wanted to help Xander.
"No,"
said the boy, and though he still smiled, his voice sounded quiet and still, like the water had become around us. He looked right at me.
"I belong here."
Now, my eyes fixed on the crowd in front of me, I feel that same feeling of relief and release as I see a familiar face, someone who, until now, I had been desperately worried about. Someone I must have thought had drowned or slipped or been pulled under and might never be seen again. Kai Markham is here, and he looks right at me. Without thinking, I take a step toward him. That's when I feel something burst beneath my feet. The lost tablet container has broken open, and everything it is supposed to protect has spilled out on the floor and been crushed under my feet. Blue, green, red. I stop in my tracks, but the movement has been noted. Officials swarm toward me, and the people around me draw breath and call out, "Over here! It's broken!" I have to turn away when an official takes my elbow and asks me what happened. When I look back at where Kai stood, he has disappeared. Just like he did that day into the pool. Just like his face did earlier on the port at my house. Chapter 6. "There was a new boy at the pool today," I told my parents that long ago night after the incident while Xander and I were swimming. I was careful to leave out any mention of Xander losing his tablet container.
I didn't want him to get in trouble. The emission felt like the tablet itself stuck in my throat. Every time I swallowed, I felt it catch there, threatening to choke me. But still, I didn't tell. My parents exchanged glances.
A new boy? Are you sure?
My father asked. I'm sure, I said. His name is Kai Markham. Xander and I swam with him.
He's staying with the Markhams then,
my father said. They've adopted him, I told my parents. He calls Ada his mother and Patrick his father. I heard him. My parents exchanged glances. Adoptions were and are virtually unheard of in our province of Oria. We heard a knock on the door.
Stay here, Kasia,
my father said.
Let us see who it is.
I waited back in the kitchen, but I heard Xander's father, Mr. Caro, at the door, his deep, loud voice booming through the foyer. We aren't allowed to go into one another's residences, and I could imagine him standing there on the steps, looking like an older version of Xander. Same blonde hair, same laughing blue eyes.
I talked with Patrick and Ada Markham, he said. I thought you'd want to know. The boy is an orphan. He's from the outer provinces.
He is? My mother's voice held a note of concern. The outer provinces are on the geographic fringe of the society, where life is harder and wilder. Sometimes people refer to them as the lesser provinces, or the backward provinces, because they have so little order and knowledge there. There's a higher concentration of aberrations there than in the general populace, and even anomalies, some say, though no one knows for certain where the anomalies are. They used to be kept in safe houses, but many of those stand empty these days.
He's here with full society approval, Mr. Caro said. Patrick showed me the paperwork himself. He told me to tell anyone else who might be concerned. I knew you'd be worried, Molly, and you too, Abram.
Well then, my mother said, it sounds all right. I edged around the corner to look into the foyer, where my parents' backs were to me and Xander's father stood on the steps with the knight behind him. Then Xander's father dropped his voice, and I had to listen closely to hear what he said over the low hum of the port in the foyer.
Molly, you should have seen Ada and Patrick. They seemed alive again. The boy is Ada's nephew, her sister's son.
My mother's hand went up to her hair, a gesture she always made when she was uncomfortable, because we all remembered vividly what had happened to the Markhams. It was a rare case of government failure. A Class 1 anomaly should never have been unidentified, let alone allowed to roam the streets, to sneak into the government offices where Patrick worked and where his son was visiting him that day. We all kept quiet about it, but we all knew. Because the Markham boy was gone, murdered while he waited for his father to come back from a meeting elsewhere in the building. Because Patrick Markham himself had to spend time being healed. Since the anomaly waited in the office, quiet, and attacked Patrick too. Her nephew, my mother said, her voice filled with empathy. Of course Ada would want to raise him.
And the government might feel like they owed it to Patrick to make an exception for him,
my father said. Abram, my mother said reproachfully. But Xander's father agreed.
It's logical. An exception as recompense for the accident. A son to replace the one that they shouldn't have had to lose. That's how the officials see it.
Later, my mother came to my room to tuck me in. With her voice soft like the blankets she settled around me, she asked, "Did you hear us talking?" "Yes," I said. "The Markham's nephew, son, starts school tomorrow." "Kai," I said. "That's his name." "Yes," she said. She bent down and her long blonde hair swung over her shoulder, and her freckles looked like stars scattered across her skin. She smiled at me.
"You'll be nice to him, won't you?"
she asked.
"And help him fit in? It might be hard to be new when everyone else belongs."
"I will," I promised. As it turned out, her advice was unnecessary. The next day at second school, Kai said hello and introduced himself to everyone. Quiet and quick, he moved through the halls. He told everyone who he was so that no one had to ask. When the bell rang, he disappeared into the groups of students. It was shocking how quickly he vanished. He was there 1 minute, separate and distinct and new, and then he became part of the crowd, as though he had done it all of his life, as if he had never lived anywhere but here. And that is how it's always been with Kai, I realize now, looking back. We have always seen him swimming along the surface. Only that first day did we see him dive deep. I have something to tell you, I say to Grandfather as I pull up a chair next to him. The officials didn't keep me too long at the game center after I stepped on the tablets. I still have enough time for a visit. I'm grateful because this is the second to last time that I will visit him. The thought makes me feel hollow.
Ah,
Grandfather says.
Something good?
He sits by the window, as he often does at night. He watches the sun out of the world and the stars into it, and sometimes I wonder if he watches the sun come up again. Is it hard to sleep when you know you're almost at the end? Do you not want to miss a moment, even those that would otherwise seem dull and unremarkable? In the night, the colors wash out of the world, gray and black take over. Now and then, a bright pinprick of light flashes as a street lamp lights up. The air train tracks, dull in the daylight, look like beautiful glowing paths above the ground now that their evening lights have been turned on. As I watch, an air train rushes past, carrying people along in its white and lighted space. Something strange, I say, and Grandfather puts down his fork. He is eating a piece of something called pie, which I have actually never tasted, but it looks delicious. I wish that it weren't against the rules for him to share his food with me. Everything's fine. I'm still matched to Xander, I say. I've learned from the society that this is the way to give news. Reassurance first, all else after. But there was an error with my microcard. When I went to view it, Xander's face vanished, and I saw someone else.
You saw someone else?
I nod, trying not to look too hard at the food on his dish. The flakiness of the sugared crust, which reminds me of crystals on an edge of snow. The red-stained berries smeared across the plate, ripe and surely full of taste. The words I've said cling to my mind like the pastry does to the heavy silver fork. I saw someone else.
What did you feel when you saw that other boy's face come up on the screen?
Grandfather asks kindly, putting his hand on mine.
Were you worried?
A little, I say. I was confused, because I know the second boy, too. Grandfather's eyebrows curve in surprise.
You do?
It's Kai Markham, I tell him, Patrick and Ada's son. He lives in Mapletree Borough, down the street from me.
What explanation did the official give you for the mistake?
It wasn't a mistake by the society, I say. The society doesn't make mistakes.
Of course not,
Grandfather says, his tone measured and even.
People do, though.
That's what the official thinks must have happened. She thinks someone must have altered my microcard and put Kai's face on there.
Why?
Grandfather wonders. She thinks it was some kind of cruel joke because... I lower my voice even further. Of Kai's status. He's an aberration. Grandfather pushes out of his chair, knocking his tray to the ground. I'm surprised to see how thin he's grown. But he stands straight as a tree.
There was a picture of an aberration as your match?
Just for a moment, I say, trying to reassure him. But it was an error. Xander's my match. This other boy wasn't even in the matching pool at all.
Grandfather doesn't sit down. Even though I remain in my chair, hoping to calm him, to make him see that this is all right.
Did they say why he was classified that way?
His father did something, I say. It isn't Kai's fault. And it isn't. I know it, and Grandfather knows it. The officials never would have allowed the adoption if Kai himself had been a threat. Grandfather looks at the plate where it clattered from the tray onto the floor. I move to pick it up, but he stops me.
No,
he says sharply. And then he bends creakily, as if he were made of old wood, an old tree, stiff wooden joints. He pushes the last pieces of food back onto the plate, and then he looks at me with his sharp, clear eyes. Nothing stiff about them. They are alive, full of movement.
I don't like it, he says. Why would someone change your microcard?
Grandfather, I say, please sit down. It's a prank, and they'll find out who did it and take care of everything. An official from the matching department said so herself. I wish I hadn't told him. Why did I think there would be comfort in the telling? But now there is.
That poor boy,
Grandfather says, his voice sad.
He's been marked through no fault of his own. Do you know him well?
We're friendly, but we're not close. I see him sometimes during free rec hours on Saturdays. He received his permanent work position a year ago, and so I don't see him much anymore.
And what is his work position?
I hesitate to tell Grandfather because it is such a dismal one. We were all surprised when Kai received such a lowly assignment, since Patrick and Ada are well respected. He works at the Nutrition Disposal Center. Grandfather makes a grimace.
Oh, that's hard, unfulfilling work.
I know, I say. I've noticed that, in spite of the gloves the workers wear, Kai's hands are permanently red from the heat of the machines. But he does not complain.
And the official let you tell me this?
Grandfather asks. Yes, I say. I asked her if I could tell one person. You. Grandfather's eyes gleam mischievously.
Because the dead can't talk.
No, I say. I love Grandfather's jokes, but I can't joke back. Not about this. It's coming too quickly. I will miss him too much. I wanted to tell you because I knew you would understand.
Ah,
Grandfather says, raising his eyebrows in a wry expression.
And did I?
Now I am laughing, a little. Not as well as I'd hoped. You acted like my parents would have if I'd told them.
Of course I did,
he says.
I want to protect you.
Not always, I think, raising my eyebrows back at him. Grandfather is the one who finally made me stop sitting at the edge of the pool. He joined us there one summer day and asked,
"What is she doing?"
"That's what she always does," Xander said.
"Can't she swim?"
Grandfather asked, and I had glared at him because I could speak for myself. He knew that.
"She can," Xander said. "She just doesn't like to do it."
"I don't like the jumping in part," I informed Grandfather.
"I see,"
he said.
"What about the diving board?"
"Especially not that."
"All right,"
he told me. He sat next to me on the edge. Even back then, when he was younger and stronger, I remember thinking how old he looked compared to my friend's grandparents. My grandparents were one of the last couples who chose to be matched later in life. They were 35 when they matched. My father, their one child, wasn't born until 4 years later. Now, no one is allowed to have a child after they turn 31. The sun shone right through his silver hair and made me see each strand even when I wasn't looking for such detail.
It made me sad, even though he made me angry.
This is exciting, he said, kicking his feet in the water. I can see how you'd never want to do anything but sit.
I heard the teasing in his voice and turned away. Then he stood up and walked toward the diving board.
Sir, said the water guard in charge of the pool.
Sir? I have a recreational pass, Grandfather told her, not stopping. I'm in excellent health.
Then he climbed up the ladder to the diving board, looking stronger and stronger the higher he climbed. He didn't look over at me before he jumped. He went right in, and before he broke through the surface of the water, I was on my feet, walking across the hot, wet cement to the high dive ladder, the soles of my feet and my pride both on fire. And I jumped.
You're thinking of the pool, aren't you?
He asks me now. Yes, I say, laughing a little. You didn't keep me safe then. You practically dared me to leap to my death. And then I cringe, because I didn't mean to say that word. I don't know why I'm afraid of it. Grandfather isn't. The society isn't. I shouldn't be. Grandfather doesn't seem to notice.
You were ready to jump, he says. You just weren't sure of it yet.
We both fall silent, remembering. I try not to look at the timepiece on the wall. I have to leave soon so I can make curfew, but I don't want Grandfather to think that I am marking the minutes, marking time until our visit is over, marking time until his life is over. Although, if you think about it, I am marking time for my own life, too. Every minute you spend with someone gives them a part of your life and takes part of theirs. Grandfather senses my distraction and asks me what is on my mind. I tell him, because I won't have many more chances to do so, and he reaches out and grips my hand.
I'm glad to give you part of my life, he says.
And it is such a nice thing to say, and he says it so kindly that I say it back. Even though he is almost 80, even though his body seemed frail earlier, his grip feels strong, and again I feel sad. There's something else I wanted to tell you, I say to Grandfather. I signed up for hiking as my summer leisure activity. He looks pleased.
They've brought that back?
Grandfather used to hike as one of his leisure activities years ago, and he's talked about it ever since.
I thought hiking was gone for good.
It's new this summer. I've never seen it offered before.
I wonder who the instructor is, he says thoughtfully.
Then he looks out the window.
I wonder where they'll take you to hike.
I follow his gaze again. There isn't much wildness out there, though we have plenty of green space, parks, and recreation fields. Maybe to one of the larger recreation areas, I say.
Maybe to the hill,
he says, the light returning to his eyes. The hill is the last place in the city that has been left forested and wild. I can see it now. Its prickly green back rising out of the arboretum where my mother works. It was once mostly used for army training, but since most of the army has been moved to the outer provinces, there isn't as much need for it anymore. Do you think so? I ask, excited. I've never been there before. I mean, I've been to the arboretum lots of times, of course, but I've never had permission to go on the hill.
You'll love it if they let you hike the hill,
Grandfather says, his face animated.
There's something about climbing to the highest point you can see, and there's no one clearing a path for you. No simulator. Everything's real.
Do you really think they'll let us hike there? I ask. His enthusiasm is contagious.
I hope so.
Grandfather gazes out the window in the direction of the arboretum, and I wonder if the reason he spends so much time looking out lately
is because he likes to remember what he carries within. It is as though he can read my mind.
I'm nothing but an old man sitting here thinking about his memories, aren't I?
I smile. There's nothing wrong with doing that. In fact, at the end of a life, it's encouraged.
That's not exactly what I'm doing,
Grandfather said. Oh?
I'm thinking.
Again, he knows my thoughts.
It's not the same as remembering. Remembering is part of thinking, but not all of it.
What are you thinking about?
Many things. A poem? An idea? Your grandmother.
My grandmother died early of one of the last kinds of cancer when she was 62. I never knew her. The compact was hers before it was mine. A gift from her mother-in-law, grandfather's mother. What do you think she would say about my match? I ask him. About what happened today. He's quiet, and I wait.
I think, he says finally, she would ask you if you wondered.
I want to ask him what he means, but I hear the bell ringing, announcing that the final air train for the Burrows will be coming through soon. I have to go.
Kasia?
Grandfather says as I stand up.
You still have the compact I gave you, don't you?
Yes, I say, surprised that he would ask. It's the most valuable thing I own, the most valuable thing I will ever own.
Will you bring it to my final banquet tomorrow?
He asks. Tears well in my eyes. He must want to see it again to remember my grandmother and his mother. Of course I will, Grandfather.
Thank you.
My tears threaten to spill over onto his cheek as I bend down to kiss him. I hold them back. I don't cry. I wonder when I can. It won't be tomorrow night at the final banquet. People will be watching then, to see how Grandfather handles leaving and to see how we manage being left. As I walk down the hall, I hear other residents talking to themselves or to visitors behind their closed doors, and the sound of ports turned up loud because many of the elderly cannot hear well. Some rooms are silent. Perhaps some are like Grandfather, sitting in front of open windows and thinking about people who are no longer here. She would ask you if you wondered. I step into the elevator and punch the button, feeling sad and strange and confused. What did he mean? I know Grandfather's time is running out. I have known this for a long time, but why, as the elevator doors slide shut, do I suddenly feel that mine is running out as well? My grandmother would want to know if I wondered if it wasn't a mistake after all, if Kai were meant to be my match. For a moment, I did. When I saw Kai's face flash in front of me so quick, I couldn't even see the color of his eyes, only the dark of them as they looked back at me. I wondered, is it you? Chapter 7. Today is Sunday. It is Grandfather's 80th birthday, so tonight he will die. People used to wake up and wonder, will today be the end? Or lie down to sleep, not knowing if they would come back out of the dark. Now we know which day will be the end of the light and which night will be the long last one. The final banquet is a luxury, a triumph of planning, of the society, of human life and the quality of it. All the studies show that the best age to die is 80. It's long enough that we can have a complete life experience, but not so long that we feel useless. That's one of the worst feelings the elderly can have. In societies before ours, they could get terrible diseases, like depression, because they didn't feel needed anymore. And there is a limit to what the society can do, too. We can't hold off all the indignities of aging much past 80. Matching for healthy genes can only take us so far. Things didn't used to be this fair. In the old days, not everyone died at the same age, and there were all kinds of problems and uncertainty. You could die anywhere. On the street, in a medical center, as my grandmother did, even on an air train, you could die alone. No one should die alone. The hour is very early, faint blue and pale pink, as we arrive on the almost empty air train and walk along the cement pathway toward the door of Grandfather's building. I want to step off the path and take off my shoes and walk with my bare feet on the cool, sharp grass, but today is not a day to deviate from what is planned. My parents and Bram and I are all quiet, thinking. None of us have work or leisure hours. Today is for Grandfather. Tomorrow, things go back to normal again, and we will move on, and he will be gone. It's expected. It's fair. I remind myself of this as we climb into the elevator to go to his apartment. You can push the button, I tell Bram, trying to joke with him. Bram and I used to fight over who got to push the buttons when we came to visit. Bram smiles and presses the 10. For the last time, I think to myself. After today, there will be no grandfather to visit. We will have no reason to come back. Most people don't know their grandparents this well. The kind of relationship I have with my other grandparents in the farmlands is much more common. We communicate via port every few months and visit every few years. Many grandchildren watch the final banquet on the port screens, too, one step removed from what's happening. I have never envied those other children. I've pitied them. Even today, I feel that way.
How long do we have before the committee shows up?
Bram asks my father.
About half an hour, my father answers. Does everyone have their gifts?
We nod. Each of us has brought something to give Grandfather. I'm not sure what my parents chose for him, but I know Bram went to the Arboretum to get a rock from a spot as near to the hill as possible. Bram catches me looking at him, and he opens his palm to show me the rock again. It is round and brown and still a bit dirty. It looks a little like an egg, and when he brought it back yesterday, he told me that he'd found it under a tree in a pile of soft green pine needles that looked like a nest. He's going to love it, I say to Bram.
He'll love your gift, too.
Bram closes his fist around the rock again. The doors slide open, and we step out into the hall. I've made Grandfather a letter for my gift. I got up early this morning and spent time cutting and pasting and copying sentiments on the letter-making program on the port. Before I printed the letter, I found a poem from the decade in which he was born and included it as well. Not many people care about poetry after they finish school, but Grandfather always has. He's read all of the 100 poems many times. One of the doors along the hall opens and an old woman peeks her head out.
You're going to the banquet for Mr. Reyes?
She asks, and she doesn't even wait for us to answer.
It's private, isn't it?
It is,
my father says, stopping politely to speak with her, even though I know he is eager to see his father. He can't keep himself from glancing down the hall at Grandfather's closed door. The woman grumbles a little.
I wish it were public. I'd like to go so I can get ideas. Mine's in less than 2 months. You can bet it's going to be public.
She laughs a little, a short, harsh sound, and then she asks,
Can you come and tell me about it afterward?
My mother comes to the rescue, as she and my father always do for each other. Perhaps, Mama says, smiling, and she takes my father's hand and turns her back on the woman. We hear a disappointed sigh, and then a click behind us as the woman closes her door. The nameplate on her door says Mrs. Nash, and I remember that Grandpa has talked about her before. Nosy, he said.
Can't she wait for her own turn to come instead of talking about it on Grandfather's Day?
Bram mutters, pushing open the door to Grandfather's residence. It already feels like a different place. More hushed, a little lonelier. I think that is because Grandfather is not sitting at the window anymore. Today he rests in a bed in the living room as his body shuts down, right on time.
Could you move me over to the window?
Grandfather asks, after saying hello to all of us.
Certainly.
My father reaches for the edge of the bed and pulls it smoothly toward the early morning light.
Remember when you did this for me? When I had all those inoculations as a child?
Grandfather smiles.
That was a different house.
And a different view,
my father agrees.
All I could see from that window was the neighbor's yard and an air train track, if I looked high enough.
But beyond that, there was sky,
Grandfather says softly.
You can almost always see the sky. And what's beyond that, I wonder. And after this?
Bram and I exchanged glances. Grandfather must be wandering a little today, which is to be expected. On the day the elderly turn 80, the decline always accelerates. Not everyone dies at exactly the same time, but it is always before midnight.
I've invited my friends to come right after the committee visits,
Grandfather says.
And then, after they leave, I'd like to spend some one-on-one time with each of you. Starting with you, Abrin.
My father nods.
Of course.
The committee does not take long. They arrive, three men and three women, in their long white lab coats, and they bring things with them, too. The banquet clothes that Grandfather will wear, equipment for tissue preservation, a microcard with the history of his life so he can watch it on the port. With the exception of maybe the microcard, I think Grandfather will like our gifts better. After a few moments, Grandfather reappears wearing his banquet clothes. They are basically plain clothes, simple pants and a shirt and socks, but they are made of fine quality material, and he has been able to select the color. I feel something catch in my throat when I see that the color he has chosen for his clothing is a light green. We are so much alike, and I wonder if he realized when I was born that the days of our banquets would be so close together, since our birthdays are only a few days apart. We all sit politely, Grandfather in his bed and the rest of us on chairs, while the committee completes their part of the celebration.
Mr. Reyes, we present to you the microcard with images and records from your life,
they say.
It has been compiled by one of our best historians in honor of you.
Thank you,
Grandfather says, reaching out his hand. The box containing the microcard is like the silver one we receive when we are matched, except for the color, gold. The microcard inside has pictures of Grandfather as a small boy, a teenager, a man. He hasn't seen some of these images in years, and I imagine that he is excited to view them today. The microcard also includes a summary of his life in words, read by one of the historians. Grandfather turns the golden box over in his hands as I did with my silver box not long ago at the match banquet. His life cupped in his palms, as mine was. One of the women speaks next. She seems gentler than the others, but maybe that is because she is smaller and younger than the rest.
Mr. Reyes, have you chosen the person to take possession of your microcard when today is over?
My son. Abrin,
Grandfather says. She holds out the device for the tissue collection, which, as a final courtesy to the elderly, the society allows to take place privately, among family.
And we are pleased to formally announce that your data indicates you have qualified for preservation. Not everyone qualifies, as you know. And it is another honor that you can add to your already long list of achievements.
Grandfather takes the device from her and thanks her again. Before she can ask him who he's trusted with the delivery of the sample, he volunteers the information.
My son, Abram, will take care of this as well.
She nods her head. Simply swab your cheek and put the sample in here, she says, demonstrating. Then seal it up. You need to bring the sample to the Biological Preservation Department within 24 hours of the collection. Otherwise, we cannot guarantee that preservation will be effective.
I'm glad that Grandfather has qualified to have a tissue sample frozen. Now for him, death may not necessarily be the end. Someday, the Society might figure out a way to bring us back. They don't promise anything, but I think we all know that it will happen eventually. When has the Society ever failed in reaching a goal? The man next to her speaks.
The food for your guests and your own final meal should arrive within the hour.
He leans over to hand Grandfather a printed menu card.
Are there any last-minute modifications you would like to make?
Grandfather looks at the card and shakes his head.
Everything looks in order.
Enjoy your final banquet, then,
the man says, pocketing the card.
Thank you.
There is a wry twist to Grandfather's mouth as he says this, as though he knows something they don't. As the committee leaves, they all shake Grandfather's hand and say, Congratulations. And I swear that I can read Grandfather's mind as he meets their gaze with his sharp eyes. Are you congratulating me on my life or on my death?
Let's get this over with,
Grandfather says, with a spark in his eye, looking at the tissue collection device, and we all laugh at his tone. Grandfather swabs his own cheek, and then my father puts the sample in the clear glass tube and seals it shut. Some of the solemnity leaves the room now that the committee has gone.
Everything's going very well,
Grandfather says.
I am having a perfect death so far.
My father winces, an expression of pain crossing his face. I know he, like me, would prefer that Grandfather not use that word, but neither of us would think of correcting Grandfather today. The pain on my father's face makes him look younger, almost like a child for a moment. Perhaps he remembers his mother's death. So unusual, so difficult compared to a final banquet like this. After today, he will be no one's child. Even though I don't want to, I think of the murdered Markham boy. No celebration, no tissue preparation, no goodbyes. That hardly ever occurs, I remind myself. The odds of that happening are almost 1,000,000 to 1.
We have some gifts for you,
Bram says to Grandfather.
Can we give them to you now?
Bram,
my father says reproachfully.
Perhaps he wants to get the microcard ready for viewing. He has guests on the way.
I do want to do that,
Grandfather says.
I'm looking forward to seeing my life pass before my eyes, and I'm looking forward to the food.
What did you pick?
Bram asks, eager. The selections for Grandfather and his guests are the same, but it is an actual law that we must eat the food from the tray and he must eat the food on his plate. We're not allowed to share.
All desserts,
Grandfather says with a grin.
Cake, pudding, cookies, and something else. But let me see your gift before we do any of that, Bram.
Bram beams.
Close your eyes.
Grandfather obeys and holds out his hand. Bram places the rock gently into Grandfather's palm. A few particles of earth fall on the blanket covering Grandfather. And my mother reaches to brush them away. But at the last second, she pulls her hand back and smiles. Grandfather won't mind the dirt.
A rock,
Grandfather says, opening his eyes and looking down. He smiles at Bram.
I have a feeling I know where you found it.
Bram grins and ducks his head. My grandfather holds on tight to the rock.
Who's next, then?
He asks, almost merrily.
I'd like to give my gift later, during the goodbyes,
my father says quietly.
That won't leave me very much time to enjoy it,
grandfather teases. Suddenly, self-conscious about my letter, I don't want him to read it in front of everyone. I say, me too. There's a knock on the door, some of grandfather's friends. A few minutes after we let them in, more arrive, and more. And then the nutrition personnel, with all of grandfather's desserts, his last meal, with the separate trays for his guests. Grandfather lifts the covers from his tray, and a heavenly, warm fruit smell fills the room.
I thought you might like some pie,
grandfather says, looking at me. He saw me then, the other day, and I smile at him. At his signal, I lift the covers from the guest trays, and we all gather around to eat. I serve everyone else first, and then I pick up my piece of pie, flaky and warm and fruit-filled, and lift a forkful of the pastry to my mouth. I wonder if death will always taste this good. After all the guests have put down their forks and sighed in satiation, they talk with grandfather, who leans back on a pile of thick white pillows. Bram eats on, stuffing himself with bites of everything. Grandfather smiles at him from across the room, amused.
It's so good,
Bram says, around a mouthful of pie, and grandfather laughs outright, a sound so warm and familiar that I smile too and put my hand down. I was about to touch Bram's arm, tell him to quit feasting, but if grandfather doesn't mind, why should I? My father doesn't eat anything. He puts a piece of pie on a round, white plate and then holds it in his hands, juice seeping out onto the china without him noticing. A little drop of it falls to the floor when he stands up to say goodbye to grandfather's guests